Well, I was all set for one more lesson in our series on the tongue that was so much different from the others that it wasn't really on the tongue when Wednesday night I was requested to speak on the issue that we commonly call mental divorce. And I've chosen to call this sermon the three E's of mental divorce. And I not only agreed to do this, but I agreed to do so for a couple of reasons. It's a hot topic. Just about everywhere I go, people are talking about this issue. And when someone comes to me and says, I really don't know exactly what's involved, then I'm happy to address that issue. It's a timely topic. And secondly, it's a very timely topic that we have even been discussing here to a limited degree. And all the attitudes I've seen so far have been very good. I'll go so far as to say I don't think there will be any disagreement with what I'm about to say this morning on the part of anybody. But if you do, you know where I am, and we can talk about it, and we can talk about it in a good way, because all of us want the same thing. Truth has nothing to fear from investigation, and that's what this is all about. Now, time limits preclude a detailed discussion of all the splinter movements, or the splinter positions, or the variant positions that someone might take. We'll have to cover just the main course, but I want to make absolutely certain that what I say is accurate. Lying is a sin, and misrepresentation is lying. So I don't want any of that. I want to make absolutely certain that I speak only the truth in representing someone else's position and do so without emotion. Now, the first E is explanation. This is where I want to be very careful to put in the words of those who hold this position what they believe. Now, this first quote, and I won't have a lot of quotes, but this is just a very short one to illustrate one who holds this position, comes from a person who was on the way to a discussion with other brethren who were going to accuse him of inconsistency on the fellowship issue. Namely, if you get along with brethren, though you disagree, why can't we get along, though we disagree on some other things? So he sent his material to a couple of his friends to review, and here's what one of them said. This is to affirm I've read Brother So-and-so's material. I agreed with him that our differences on how to treat one whose mate is guilty of fornication following a divorce, which he tried to avoid, is a difference of judgment in the realm of application of the one law of divorce and remarriage and not the teaching of another law. Now, to some of you, I'm sure that's as clear as mud at this point. I want to clean away some of this mud. Basically, we have a couple of things going on here. First of all, a matter of application may be serious or it may not be, depending on the context of something. I met and talked to, on more than one occasion, Guy in Woods. I asked him questions publicly on at least two occasions. All the debates he ever had that I read or heard on tape, and all the questions I asked him publicly, and he responded to, he agreed on the three ways of establishing biblical authority. He agreed you had to have a commander statement, a proven example, or necessary inference. He agreed on that. But it was the application that was different. He said, I agree on the way you establish authority. If you spend 10 minutes in your first speech talking about how we establish biblical authority, you wasted your time. I agree with that. He said, it's a matter of application. Well, the major institutional division thing because of a matter of application. It's not a matter of the principle. We agree on the principles. At least at one time we did. Now some are questioning even the principles. But it started out agreeing on the principles but a matter of application. And then the second part of this quote that we just saw, here's the issue. Where does the New Testament talk about fornication following a divorce giving anyone the right to remarry? Now that's what I want to explore and probe a little. So, to state the basic position, here we go. God does not recognize a divorce or marriage that He doesn't approve. I'm quoting here now. This is not what the New Testament teaches. This is the position of the mental divorce position. That God doesn't recognize it as divorce. It's not really divorce unless He approves of it. It's not really a marriage unless He approves of it. So, He doesn't consider it real divorce or real marriage unless it's something He approves. Now, let's illustrate it even more, and I think it'll be even clearer. Here's a husband and wife who are married to one another. She says, I'm divorcing you. And there's been no fornication. She has no right to put him away. But she's divorcing him, not for fornication. Well, he begs her, no, don't do this. He fights the divorce. He tries to keep the marriage together. She won't listen. And so, though he tries to stay together, she goes on and divorces him, not for fornication. Well, after she remarries, he then mentally says, God didn't recognize that divorce in which he put me away, so I'm not really a put away person. Therefore, when she went and married this other guy, since I'm the innocent party and she's the guilty one, and God didn't see that as a real divorce, and he considers me still married to her, I mentally put her away. So that's basically the position. I hope that's clear. You can get these charts and look it over again if it's not. Now, the summary, then, of the position, not of the New Testament. I haven't gotten there yet. I haven't used a single verse yet. But not all divorces are real divorces. Not all marriages are real marriages. You can see that from what we just said. This husband and wife were married. She put him away and married someone else. But when she put him away, they're saying that's not a real divorce. When she marries him, that's not a real marriage. Now, here's the kicker in it. All marriages are awful in God's sight. Remember, when she married this other man, that's not really a marriage. A marriage is only something that's real. And since this is not real, then that's not something we can call a marriage, really. And so sometimes they use the expression, in God's eyes, they're not married. But all marriages are things that God does recognize, and all divorces are things that God recognizes. If a marriage is not lawful, it's not really a marriage. All divorces are lawful. If a divorce is not lawful, then it's not really a divorce. So you see, there's a matter of wordplay that we need to delve into in this issue. This is basically, as we're going to see in a study of the texts now, starting in Matthew 5, this is basically what we would call equivocation. Now, this is the second E. When I say equivocation, I'm not impugning anybody's motives. I'm not saying someone is doing so dishonestly. I'm just saying this is the consequences. I'm not judging anybody's heart. I'm just saying, here's the result. Now, what is equivocation? Well, that's misleading language. It's when you use a key word in two or more offenses. For example, you pull up into a parking lot and it says, fine for parking here. So since it was fine, I parked there. You see what I've done? That's equivocation. That sounds like something I would say, incidentally. Here's another. A plane is a carpenter's tool. The Boeing 747 is a plane. Therefore, the Boeing 747 is a carpenter's tool. That's equivocation. I love to do this with children. It's kind of fun. It gets rather serious when we deal with marriage issues, though. It gets more serious when we talk about someone who's been baptized. Someone was baptized not for the forgiveness of sins. You study with him, and he starts to see, baptism is for the forgenness of sins. And as he thinks about it, he says, yes, that's the reason I was baptized. So he tries to apply his present understanding to his past action. It won't work. That's the point in Acts 19. These people have been baptized into John's baptism, and learning the truth about baptism wouldn't change the reality of what they had done in the past. We understand that. Now, the same thing occurs when we speak on the marriage issue. Some people make the same word, the word divorce, means something that is real and actual if God approves of it, or something that is unreal and non-existent if God doesn't approve. Does that help clarify the position here? That's why I call it equivocation. And yet Jesus used the one word to apply to situations that he did not approve of, as well as to those situations he did approve of. He used it of both. If we can understand that Jesus used the one word to describe situations he did not approve of, as well as the situations he did approve of, then the so-called mental divorce position doesn't have a leg to stand on. Now, that's why we want to go to the text. Nobody listening to Jesus when he was speaking on this subject, nobody in that audience would have concluded that he was using divorce and marry in these two different senses. Namely, that here it's real, there it's not real. Here it's something actual, there it's something that is just fake and God doesn't really see it. For example, imagine someone sitting there saying, now Jesus used the word divorce, or this time he means a real divorce. And then he hears him use it again and he says, well, he says divorce, but he doesn't really mean it this time. He means something else. Well, I wonder why Jesus didn't say what he meant then. That gets down to the heart of the issue, I believe. Now, let's go into Matthew chapter 5. I want to read verses 31 and 32. Unlike most lessons that I have, I don't have a lot of verses this time, but we're going to read the same ones over and over again. So we're going to have the same amount of Scripture, but it's going to be emphasizing the same ones. Matthew 5:31. Moreover, furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason, except sexual immorality, I'm going to call it fornication for the most part, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. I think that's very clear, straight. This man has the power, not the privilege, but he has the power to divorce his wife for a cause other than fornication. It's a simple putting away. You see that? I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason, and take that as an exception, causes her to commit adultery. So what's he doing? He's divorcing his wife. It's real. It's not acceptable to God, but it is real. And that's the word Jesus uses. The same term describes a scriptural putting away, one that is for fornication, and an unscriptural putting away, one that is not for fornication. Look at it in verse 32. Whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality. There are two puttings away here. One time he puts away for just any reason. She has bad breath, so I put her away. He still uses the word divorce. Here's the other fellow who puts her away because she committed fornication. He still calls it divorce. In the one instance, it's not approved of God, but he calls it divorce. In the second, it is approved of God, but he still calls it divorce. And that's what your text there says. Whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. Furthermore, the issue is not whether God approves of the action. That's when he puts her away for bad breath or burning the bread or something. He doesn't approve of it. That's not the issue. The issue is whether he recognizes it, whether he sees it, whether he admits that it exists. And he does. He clearly does. He calls it this. Whoever divorces his wife for some reason other than fornication. See? Now, in Matthew 5:32, we continue. Since the man's unlawful divorce causes the wife to commit adultery, then she was innocent at the time he put her away. Can you see that? She didn't do something that deserved being put away, so she was innocent. Notice it. I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason, except fornication, causes her to commit adultery. He leaves her into this, but the time he put her away, she was not guilty. Here's a woman then who is unjustly put away, and yet Jesus calls it divorce. Now, did he mean what he said? And if not, did he deceive the people? That's the issue here. It's a pretty serious issue. Now, if we let any false teacher on any issue define his terms and decide when Jesus means what he says and what he doesn't, you talk about a Pandora's box. He can prove anything he wants to. He can prove literally anything he wants to. I don't grant him that permission. He's going to have to use terms the way Jesus used the terms. Now, what if someone in the audience said, Lord, wait a minute. You used the word divorce about this man. He put away his wife, not for fornication. You called that divorce. That's not real divorce. She's innocent. What if somebody had said that? Correcting Jesus. That's pretty presumptuous, isn't it? Well, if this fellow's true, Why didn't Jesus say that? In fact, why did he say just the opposite? Look at it again. I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality, what does your Bible say? That he puts her away for some reason other than fornication and leads her into adultery. Now, according to this passage then, an innocent person can be put away. Some people deny that. They deny that an innocent person can be divorced. What does it say? Whoever divorces his wife for any reason except for fornication causes her to commit adultery. Now, let's take out the except for fornication for a minute. Here's the man who puts her away not for the right reason. I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason causes her to commit adultery. Isn't that simple? An innocent person is put away. In Matthew 19, verse 6, when Jesus said, he's reaching his conclusion here, so then there are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, notice it now, let not man separate. He doesn't say, you cannot separate. It's impossible for you to separate. You can call it that, but it's not real. Why would he give the command not to do it if we can't do it? Notice he doesn't say, you don't have the power to do it. He says, you don't have the permission to do it. There's a major difference between those two. You can do it, but not with my approval. Let not this man do this. Okay? Now back to Matthew 5:32. Where does this passage or any other give this put away woman the right to remarry? See, if you say, well, she's not really divorced, and since she's not really divorced, when he marries somebody else, then she can mentally say, now I've put you away. She's the put away person according to this passage. That's why whoever marries this woman who is divorced commits adultery. The last part of Matthew 5:32. What did Jesus mean when he said that her remarriage to another would be adultery? What did he mean when he said that? Well, she was put away. It didn't mean God approved of the putting away, but she's an innocent person put away. Whoever marries her commits adultery. What did he mean when he said that? Now, this is not really that hard to understand, is it? Our problem is not understanding what this says. It's saying, well, she's innocent. This just doesn't seem fair. More about that in a moment. But that's really the problem with people. We don't like what he says, and therefore we have to change what he said. A put-away person commits adultery when he or she remarries. Look again at the last part of verse 32. Whoever marries a person who is divorced, this is this put-away person, the first wife of this man who put her away for some cause other than fornication, whoever marries her commits adultery. Okay? Now, again, in this passage, where does the passage tell us if the woman agreed with the divorce or protested it? All we know is she was put away. We don't know a word she said or a single attitude that she expressed. Some people say, well, if this woman fought this divorce and tried to keep it together, and then he went through something that in men's eyes we're going to call the putting away, but God never saw it. Now, since she tried to save it and he wouldn't listen and he commits fornication, now she can really put him away. Where does it say anything about her attitude anywhere in this passage? We don't know if she agreed or disagreed. It says nothing about her later putting him away and then remarrying any more than it says about her attitude. So here's a matter of respecting the silence of the Scripture. And notice further in this passage, the only exception belongs to the person who does the putting away, not to the put away person. Verse 32, I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except fornication causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. She's the put-away person. She didn't have the right to remarry. Now, does divorce mean the same thing in Matthew 19, verse 9, in both instances where it occurs in this passage? This is very similar to Matthew 5, verse 32. Matthew 19, 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality. We might illustrate it this way. Here is a divorce that occurs. One is for fornication. You're seeing here the reason why PowerPoint is a good thing. Here is one that is not for fornication. So here's a divorce, Matthew 19:9. Whoever divorces his wife, except for this one thing. So here's one who divorces not for that, and here's one who divorces for that. Same word covers both, doesn't it? Notice the word divorce covers what God accepts and what God does not accept. Can you see that in the verse? Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality, fornication, and marries another. What about the word marry? Does God approve of this frivolous divorce? No. Does He still call it divorce, thus recognizing what He did? Yes, He calls it divorce. Does marry mean the same thing? After these people divorce, this one marries. This one down here, after his divorce, that is unscriptural divorce, but he still calls it that, he marries. Okay? Same Mary. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another. Both of these men are marrying now again. We call it a remarriage. Whoever does that, except for this one reason, commits adultery. So this one down here who didn't do it for the right reason is guilty of adultery. This one up here is not an adulterer. But God uses the same term, marries and divorce, to describe both actions. He disapproves of one, He approves of the other. But don't say, well, this is not a real divorce and this is not a real marriage. Jesus said they are. That's the term He used. Whoever divorces his wife except for fornication and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now, further in Matthew 19, verse 9, what is the condition of the man who puts away his wife and remarries another, not for the cause of fornication? Well, whoever divorces his wife except for fornication and marries another commits adultery. So that's his circumstance. So God didn't approve of what he did, but he does recognize what he did. May this put away person marry another. Look at the last part of verse 9. Whoever marries her who is divorced, the one who was put away, commits adultery. So may the put away person marry another? If so, what passage would teach it? And look, what does this passage say? It says when she marries again, she commits adultery. That's the very issue. There's none of this business about her saying, well, she fought this divorce, and when he put her away, it wasn't real putting away. And when he married somebody else, now she can say, now I put you away. She's the put away person, according to the very language Jesus uses in the text. And when she remarries, she commits adultery. Now, when does the except for fornication phrase apply? Is it at the time of the divorce, he's putting her away for this purpose? Or is it days, or weeks, or months, or years later? Look at it again. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for fornication and marries another. Except for fornication. He divorces her except for that. Well, that's showing at the time of the divorce. That's why he puts her away. It's because she had committed fornication, right? Now, do we know whether the wife in this text wanted the divorce or fought it? Does it say that divorcing her required her consent? That she has to say, all right, I accept this divorce, now we're really divorced. It doesn't say anything about that, does it? So, since the text doesn't discuss her attitude, does it affect the Lord's conclusion? Well, no. That'd be reading into the text something that just isn't there. Since the woman is the put-away person, she's put away not for the cause of fornication, and she's innocent, does that change what the text says about her remarriage to another? No, you have an innocent woman here. She didn't do anything. He's put her away not for fornication. He's divorced her not for fornication. She was an innocent person. Does the text say anything about her remarriage? Yeah, she's the put-away person, and if she remarries, here's her situation. Same as in Matthew 5. Now, does this passage say that this put-away person may later divorce this man after he remarries? No, that'd be reading in the text something it doesn't say. That's what the so-called mental divorce position affirms, but it's not in the text. What would she put away anyway? Turn back with me to Matthew chapter 15. There's an occasion when Jesus is feeding the 4,000. This word for putting away or divorce in Matthew 19:9 occurs two times in Matthew 15:32-39. It's about the 4,000 And he says, I do not want to send them away, the last part of verse 32, hungry, lest they faint on the way. So, verse 39 says, he sent away the multitude, got into the boat, and came to the region of Magdala. Now, could they later, after they'd been sent away, meet somewhere else? Could they say, well, I don't like the fact he sent us away. We mentally send him away. What is there to send away? The relationship has already been severed. They're apart already. And the same way with this woman. What would she put away? He's already divorced her. He's gone and he's living with another woman. Now, what is it she's going to divorce or put away once she's already the put away person? What is there? An illustration of this we have in Mark chapter 6. And it's a very interesting and powerful illustration. It shows Herodias was Philip's wife, Herod's brother. She was the wife of his brother, and Herod had married her. Look at Mark 6, verse 17. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Okay? Herod had married her. John calls this marriage unlawful. Notice, he doesn't say, well, this is not a real marriage. He doesn't say, this is a marriage in men's eyes and not in God's eyes. The Bible never uses that kind of terminology. He admits this is a marriage. Now, does God approve of it? No, it's unlawful. But he still recognizes what it is. It is a marriage. Look at it. For he, last part of verse 17, for he had what? Married her. Had he or had he not? Had he married her? And then verse 18, because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have. You see that as a technical term, 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Corinthians 5, another place is John 4, for Mary. It's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Okay? So though Herod had married her, verse 17, God did not approve this marriage. It wasn't in harmony with his law, verse 18. And he plainly says so. That's why John was killed. Now, the conclusion of this passage is this. God recognized there was a marriage between Herod and Herodias. He calls it such. But he didn't approve it. Look at it again. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. God recognizes a variety of sins, but he doesn't approve them. If I go out today and get angry at somebody and take a gun and shoot him and kill him, God recognizes what I've done. I've committed murder. Now, is it lawful? No. Does he recognize what I've done? Yes. And if a person leaves here and commits adultery, marries somebody else, does God call it marriage? Yes. Does he approve of it? No. He recognizes a host of sins that he doesn't approve of. Luke 16, verse 18. In this passage, we have similar statements, very strongly put, though, where he says in verse 18, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. Now, what does divorce mean in its two uses in this passage? Well, it's used in the same way in both of these. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Whoever marries the one who is divorced. Here's the put away and the put away. Both of them end up in an adulterous relationship. If divorce doesn't mean divorce, then what would it mean? Is the put away person divorced or is she not? Well, it says, whoever marries her who is what? Who is divorced. So, apparently Jesus knew what he meant and meant what he said. Though Jesus didn't approve of it, what did he call it? Well, he said she's divorced. Okay? Now, if the sinful putting away is nothing, some people say, well, when this husband divorces his wife, he didn't have any right to. Well, that's nothing. It's as though it never took place. God never even saw it. Well, if it's nothing, then what difference does it make who initiated it? It wouldn't matter if he did or she did, would it? Because it's nothing. Remember, nothing is nothing and can never be something. And if it's not something, then what difference does it make who would do it? And furthermore, when someone else marries this put-away woman, is she still married to her first husband? That'd be polygamy. She's not married to one and then married to the other, too. But he calls it marriage. She whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. She's still married to her first husband. Now he says she's married to this one. No, she's not married to her first husband anymore. We'll see that a little later in 1 Corinthians 7. When he divorces her, they're not still married. She's still bound, but they're not married. There's a difference in the bond and the marriage. Now, is this woman married to the second man or not? What did Jesus say? Did he mean what he said? Well, he said, whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. He said, whoever marries her. And that's what he called it. Now, is husband number two married to her or not? What does the text say? It says he marries her. I'm just going to have to take what the Lord said. Now, with that in mind, this notice the order. This man, first of all, divorces his wife. Number two, he marries another. And number three, what happens when the first wife marries again? Read it in order. Whoever divorces his wife, number one, and marries another. All right, that puts him in adultery. Now, number three, what about this woman? When she marries, what do you call it? That's what you call adultery. Isn't that simple? So can she look at him and say, well, he put me away unlawfully, therefore it's not real. And therefore, when I meet somebody I like, I'll marry him and just call that unreal. Look at the text. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband, it's okay? No, commits adultery. How simple. In this passage, who receives the right to marry again? Nobody. He doesn't even discuss the one exception, the for fornication. Does God approve of the divorce and the remarriages in this verse? No, not one of them. He doesn't approve of a single one of them. This man shouldn't have put away his wife. She shouldn't have married someone else. Being put away for, she didn't put him away for fornication. That's the only way she could have put him away and remarried. Now, if you go to Romans 7, here we have a case where Paul is illustrating by marriage the Jews' relationship to the old law. Romans 7, verse 1, do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. Notice the last phrase of verse 1, as long as he lives, is the exact phrase you have here with this woman. As long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. What is she doing? She's marrying somebody else. She joins herself to another. She's called an adulteress. That's what adultery is, when you're bound to one and joined to another. But if her husband dies, she is free. That's the same as the release to verse 2, in effect. She is free from that law so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Now, if this woman, while bound to her first husband, marries another man, is she bound to two men? No, she's no longer bound to one. Here's this woman who's bound to her first husband, but when she marries this other, she's not bound to him. God never joined this second one together. That's adultery. They're not bound. And second, does marry or join mean two different things in this passage? Notice the first part of verse 3, her husband lives, she marries another. She's in adultery. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like this right here, doesn't it? But then if her husband's dead, this is not talking about the one exception, but you could write death up here and she remarries, and that's not adultery either. If he dies, she's free from that law so that she's no adulteress, though she has married another man both times, the marriage or the joining. But one is approved and one is not. Yet he uses the same term to describe both. Now, does God approve of both marriages? No, only one. Now, this brings us then to the discussion of emotion. This is our third E. We had explanation, equivocation, and now emotion. Many times we've known of situations where a family member or a friend will get into a situation. We hate to see that occur. We hate to admit this family member or friend would be in adultery, and so it's very tempting for some to rewrite God's law or to reroute your path from here to there. So emotions end up replacing revelation. It's kind of like the fellow who says, I can't stand the thought that my old Aunt Jemima died and she wasn't a Christian and she'd be lost just because she wasn't baptized. We need to figure out a way to get her in heaven. Well, the Scriptures are very plain on what we need to do. We don't have the right to rewire God's plan on that or any other subject. Now, sometimes people say, well, it's not fair for the innocent party to be put away and have to remain celibate. It's just not fair. Okay? This is an emotional issue, not a scriptural one. We're dealing with emotions. Let me illustrate this in 1 Corinthians 7. In 1 Corinthians 7, when two divorce, not for fornication, they have two alternatives. They may, first of all, remain unmarried, or they may be reconciled to each other. But there's not a third option. 1 Corinthians 7:10, now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. Now notice in verse 10, they were married. He was her husband. But as a result of what she does in verse 11, she departs. Now she is unmarried. Somebody says, well, she's still married in God. What does it say? She's unmarried. Paul called her unmarried. Now, she's bound to her husband, but she's no longer married to him. What does unmarried mean? It means you're not married. So, in verse 10, she was married. She's departed from her husband. And if she does depart, she can remain unmarried. That is, if she can't persuade him to take her back. Or be reconciled to her husband. And that would be the preferable of the two courses here. And her husband's not to do the same with the wife. Neither is allowed to remarry another. They didn't even discuss that possibility. The only way to evade what Jesus said in these texts that we've seen is somehow to change the put away person into one who puts away. Here's the reasoning that goes into it. This woman who's been put away, she can't remarry anybody else. But we have to change it so instead of her being put away, she is the one who does the putting away. Because that's the only one who has the right to remarry in any event. So, when the husband puts away the wife, not for fornication, we're going to say that's not a real putting away. God didn't even call that a putting away. Of course, we know He does, but we're assuming this is a theory here. So that's not a putting away. Now, later, maybe years later, when he remarries, she says, ah! Now I have the right to put him away. It'll be scriptural because he's still married to me and God still recognizes our union and he's committed fornication and therefore he's put away. I'm mentally saying, I send you away. He hadn't lived with her for years. Hadn't had anything to do with each other for years. There's nothing to put away. It's like the crowd saying, all right, Jesus, we put you away after you'd already sent them away. But that's the theory. Well, why is this? It's not because Jesus said this, but because of emotion. It just doesn't feel right to us that this innocent person could be treated in this way. Now, let me ask you a question. What if her husband never remarries? He puts her away unjustly and he never remarries. What's she going to have to do? Remain celibate. Now, is that fair? No, but everybody admits she's going to have to live a celibate life. Is it fair? No. There are certain things in life that aren't fair. There are a number of occasions where you can see people such as Job, an innocent victim, didn't do a thing to deserve what he received, one of the finest men on earth. But life wasn't fair to Job, was it? What did he prove? That it's right to serve God even without a protective hedge about him. Listen carefully. If the children of God are immune to pain or to mistreatment, people will view the gospel as an insurance policy. I'm going to become a Christian. Because then, nothing can ever be unfair. I can't be treated unfairly. Well, people would become Christians for the wrong reasons. Friends, all we have is what Jesus said. What He said is so plain and so clear that we don't have to wonder about it. Matthew 5:32, I said, either whoever divorces his wife for any reason except for fornication causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who's divorced commits adultery. Here she's put away unjustly. But what did he say? He said very plainly, her remarriage constitutes adultery. I can't change what Jesus said. All I can do is say that's what He said. And then in conclusion, if mental divorce is when you just mentally put someone away at the end of a marriage, what they call the end of it, why not mental marriage at the very beginning? Here's this young couple, and they're in love with each other, and lust overtakes them, and they say, let's say we're married. And then they go ahead and do anything they please. Are they married? And how would you even know for sure? Surely God didn't put marriage, something so serious as marriage, on a level so frivolous as having to know what someone else is thinking. Am I really married or am I not? That didn't happen. Jesus made it very plain for us. We may not like what He said, but there's no doubt what He said, and it's up to us to accept that. I appreciate very much your attention. I hope that it's been made somewhat clear. And if anyone in this audience has never obeyed the gospel of Christ, you have that opportunity now to come and let your request be made known. If you would repent of your sins, confess your faith in the Lord, be baptized by His authority, He'll blot out your transgressions. And if you've done this in your past and have gone back to the world, won't you come back to the Lord and be saved? While together we stand and sing, we invite you to come.